the assassination of the greatest defender of the right of nations in the region against terrorism, General Qasem Soleimani, by the U.S. regime, and the assassination of our scientists of the field of peaceful nuclear science and technology, including martyr Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, by the Zionist regime, are but a portion of expenses paid by the Iranian people in the fight against terrorism.
Baghai Kani further said that Iran has been at the forefront of the fight against terrorism. He added, some Western countries have praised the notorious anti-Tehran terror group MKO, which has killed thousands of innocent people. Political commentator Jamal Mubaraka says U.S. sanctions against Iran amidst the coronavirus pandemic run counter to international rules.
To intensify the sanctions, even within the midst of the corona pandemic, displayed an attitude, a wanton rejection of the value of life in Iran. So it is important that the comments were made today to shift attention back to the illegal and immoral policies of the U.S. That in fact does reflect an attempt to impose collective punishment on innocent people in Iran. The policies of the U.S. are directed toward other nations in the midst of this coronavirus also has violated international human rights norms. So the U.S. has no moral and political standing to be in a place to criticize any country's human rights records. As long as it continues to be what many people believe to be the number one violator of human rights on the planet.
The United States says it will soon release an intelligence report on the 2018 murder of Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki made the announcement. She added that U.S. President Joe Biden is also expected to speak with Saudi Arabia's King Salman. Reports say Khashoggi's murder will be a hot topic during the phone conversation. The declassified document reportedly implies that Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman was involved in the journalist's murder. Khashoggi was a Washington Post columnist and a fierce critic of Saudi government's policies. He was assassinated by Saudi agents at the country's consulate in Istanbul in October 2018. Political commentator William Beeman says former U.S. President Donald Trump concealed the documents on the murder of Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi.
The Khashoggi murder is a scandal, and it has been hidden by the Trump administration. That is, all of the documentation that was collected was suppressed by the Trump administration, largely because of the personal and, I should say, commercial relationship between Donald Trump and Mohammed bin Salman in Saudi Arabia. Now the Biden administration has come into power, and this documentation will now be unclassified. We're waiting for the documentation to actually be declassified. Avril Haines would be the one to do this, and Ms. Haines has promised to declassify this material as soon as possible. But we know quite a lot about this assassination, and I think that there's general consensus that Mohammed bin Salman was involved in this at some level.
The UN says Israeli forces have enjoyed persistent impunity for using excessive force against Palestinian people in the occupied West Bank.
We also continue to observe persistent impunity afforded to members of the Israeli security forces for incidents of possible excessive use of force in the West Bank, including East Jerusalem. In the rare cases where convictions have been secured, the charges and sentences have appeared extremely lenient given the gravity of the conduct.
Addressing the Human Rights Council, Michelle Bachelet said Israeli forces had killed 67 Palestinians, including 16 children, between November 2019 and October 2020. She added that nearly 3,700 others were also injured during the same period. She also criticized Tel Aviv for a lack of notable progress in investigating allegations of ill treatment and torture of Palestinians in Israeli jails. Bachelet said there have been no charges brought against Israelis involved in rights violations. The UN official called on the international community to hold to account those responsible for such violations and provide redress to the victims. Activists and human rights organizations like the Palestinian Solidarity Campaign are raising the alarm amid fears that Facebook will make Zionism a de facto protected category. Already an army of trolls are numerous. Algorithms are busy removing pro-Palestinian posts on Facebook. This is all part of a stealthy campaign launched to stamp out criticism of Israel by defining it as hate speech. Baenke Rahimi has more.
Zionism is a political ideology, but Facebook might give it the same protection as race, nationality, and sexuality. Hundreds of millions across the globe define Israel's Zionist regime as the last apartheid on earth. It is a very sore historical subject, and Zionism lies at the heart of the discourse surrounding it.
I would say, like in an academic setting, if you tried to write a paper on what's happening in Palestine and you didn't mention Zionism, or Zionists, you would fail that class, right? There's no matter what your political outlook is, you have to have that discussion of Zionism to talk about accountability.
The Palestinians live in an open-air prison. Illegal settlement expansions continue, and Israeli soldiers and settlers attack Palestinians with impunity. Hundreds of activists, intellectuals, and artists have signed a petition that says making Zionism a protected category would prohibit Palestinians from sharing their daily experiences and histories with the world, be it a photo of the keys to their grandparents' house lost when attacked by Zionist militias in 1948, or a live stream of Zionism settlers attacking their olive trees in 2021. And it would prevent Jewish users from discussing their relationships to Zionist political ideology. But that is the direction Facebook is heading. This is former Director General of Israel's Justice Ministry, Emmy Palmer. On her cyber unit's watch, censorship of Palestinian social media posts increased 500%, and Facebook complied with around 95% of Tel Aviv's requests to delete Palestinian accounts. In 2020, Facebook hired Palmer as the first member of its oversight board tasked with ruling on content ethics. Since then, pages focusing on Israeli violations against Palestinians and the Arab normalization deal signed with Israel have recorded an international decrease of 50% of user reach.
I think Facebook is a very political entity, and it is subject to pressures. It's one of the big power players in the world, and we would not expect it to be immune to those pressures. What it needs to have is systems and an ideology in place which resists them. It's up to groups that object to this to mobilize and to tell Facebook that they will simply, and I think we can, go elsewhere. There are other platforms.
Facebook is under pressure to adopt a controversial definition of anti-Semitism drawn up by the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance, which literally defines and outlaws criticism of Israel as anti-Semitic. Scholars of anti-Semitism, Palestine and Israel relations, and Jewish and Holocaust history say this is dangerous. But in the end, it seems that the power lies in the hands of Facebook's 2.7 billion users. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Hundreds of Georgians have held a protest outside the jail where opposition leader Nikki Melia is held, calling for his release.
Melia's detention does not serve the interests of the country and the statehood. We staged a rally to support Nikki Melia. We will not give up.
The rally was held in the southeastern town of Rostavi. The demonstrators said protests will continue until all political prisoners are liberated and snap polls are called. Melia is the leader of Georgia's main opposition party, the United National Movement. He was arrested on Tuesday in a violent police raid on his party's headquarters. Melia is accused of inciting violence in street protests in June 2019, but his arrest comes against the backdrop of a wider and more recent political crisis. Georgia has been rocked by protests since parliamentary elections in October 2020. The opposition dismissed the polls as rigged after the ruling party Georgian Dream claimed a narrow victory. Elsewhere, officials in France have imposed new anti-COVID-19 restrictions in Dunkirk while warning of a national lockdown to deal with the worsening situation of the pandemic.
The epidemic situation is very worrying, alarming even, here in Dunkirk. One out of every 100 inhabitants in the city falls ill every week from COVID to Dunkirk and the High Flanders communes. The incidence there is now double what it was at the height of the first and second wave in this territory.
A government spokesman also stated that infections have reached worrying levels in several parts of the country and that requires rapid and strong measures. Meanwhile, Sweden announced a tightening of restrictions which include reducing the opening hours of restaurants and cafes and limiting the number of people allowed in shops at a time. The Swedish Prime Minister says the situation in the country is serious as it has a high rate of infection spread which is increasing by the day. The remarks come as Sweden registered over 5,300 new cases of the virus, the highest daily jump since early January. Turkish main opposition party continues to question former Treasury and Finance Minister Berat Albayrak, who is also President Recep Tayyip Erdogan's son-in-law, over the central bank reserve. Erdogan says the campaign is targeting his family and their fundamental rights and freedoms. Rashan Saknam reports from Istanbul.
Head of Turkey's main opposition party, CHP, Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu, questioned the fate of $128 billion during the era of former Treasury and Finance Minister Berat Albayrak, who is also the president's son-in-law, adding that the fate of both those billions and the minister are still unknown. The main opposition also questions the whereabouts of the former minister following his disappearance from the public eye after his resignation in November 2020. Erdogan emphasized that the transactions over the central bank's reserves were carried out in accordance with the regulation.
Erdogan says that his son-in-law was very successful in office. So why did he resign from his post and disappear in this suspicious way? Once again, I address the question to President Erdogan. That what has happened to the $128 billion of the central bank reserve? And why did the finance minister disappear?
Erdogan defended Albayrak as an energy minister and finance minister, saying that the reason for criticism towards Albayrak was because he was not a politician.
The resignation of former finance minister took place months ago, but the opposition continues to question the reasons behind it, and I think the issue should be viewed as part of the upcoming elections campaign.
Albayrak's abrupt resignation and his disappearance were interpreted as the government's effort to blame him for the recent financial problems the country is facing. Many also say that his father-in-law wanted him to play low-key in the meantime, for he is preparing for the 2023 elections. Observers say the resignation of Albayrak has already inflicted a heavy blow to Turkish president, and it seems that the issue could gain momentum as Turkey gets closer to the next elections. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
At least 16 people have been killed and over 50 injured in an attack by the Boko Haram terrorist group in Nigeria's northeastern state of Borno. Security forces say the terrorists fired two mortar shells on the densely populated city of Maiduguri. Nine of the dead were young boys who were hit while playing football. Boko Haram has repeatedly made incursions into Maiduguri, aiming to overrun the regional capital. Since gaining widespread exposure in 2009, the terrorist group has killed over 36,000 people and displaced around 2 million from their homes in Nigeria. The Boko Haram insurgency has caused a dire humanitarian crisis in the region, including in neighboring Niger, Chad, and Cameroon. The World Health Organization has delivered the COVID-19 vaccine shipment to Ghana, making it the first country in the world to receive shots under the organization's COVAX scheme. A flight carrying 600,000 doses of AstraZeneca Oxford vaccine produced by an Indian firm landed in Ghana's capital, Accra. Local representatives of the WHO and the United Nations Children's Agency have described the vaccine's arrival as, quote, momentous occasion. They also called the move a critical step in bringing the pandemic to an end. The UN-backed COVAX initiative, which was launched 8 months ago, aims to ensure a fairer distribution of vaccines between rich and poor nations. under the COVAX program. The UN Health Agency is expected to deliver some 2 billion doses of COVID vaccines to member states by the end of the year. Venezuela has expelled the European Union's ambassador to Caracas in response to sanctions imposed on the country by the bloc.
Today, by decision of President Nicolas Maduro, we have presented Ms. Isabel Brillante, who in recent years was the head of the European Union delegation in Venezuela, her declaration as persona non grata. According to the Vienna Convention on Diplomatic Relations, she has been given a period of 72 hours to leave Venezuelan territory.
The top Venezuelan diplomat also slammed the bloc sanctions against 19 Venezuelan officials as truly unacceptable. The EU has reacted to the expulsion of its envoy, calling on Venezuela to reverse its decision. The bloc says its sanctions on Venezuela were in response to human rights abuses and the December legislative elections won by President Nicolas Maduro's allies. The Venezuelan opposition and the West claim the vote was rigged, an allegation Caracas rejects as baseless. That brings an end to our news bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
This is IRIB English Radio. Iranian news. Iranian culture. Iranian voice. www.parstoday.com/en.
Labour MPs are being asked by the party's high command not to focus on problems caused by Brexit when asking questions in Parliament, dealing with the media, or posting on social media, according to sources in the Parliamentary Labour Party. The article you're about to hear has been written by the Observer's political editor Toby Helm. The piece is titled Labour MPs Dismay at Orders to Maintain Radio Silence on Brexit. Stay with us for more of Toby Helm's article. Labour MPs are being asked by the party's high command not to focus on problems caused by Brexit when asking questions in the House of Commons, dealing with the media, or posting on social media, according to sources in the Parliamentary Labour Party. After a week in which Labour leader Keir Starmer delivered a major speech on how the country should rebuild the economy and reduce inequality without once mentioning Brexit, relations with the European Union or the severe problems that have confronted many UK exporters since 1st of January, senior party figures reacted with astonishment. On Saturday night, former cabinet member and Europe Minister Peter Hain said Brexit had become the elephant in the room for Labour. Peter Hain told The Observer, "It's quite understandable that Brexit has not been top of Labour's agenda, but it's not sustainable to ignore this elephant in the room hurting British businesses. our vital performing arts sector, our security, and our foreign policy reach. The Tories delivered a last-minute mess of a Brexit with the damaging consequences, not least the stability on the island of Ireland. One senior backbencher said the message from the top was very clear, that there should be virtual radio silence on the issue of Brexit. The order that is coming out is, don't mention the war. We're being told that Keir Starmer wants to move on, and that if we mention the B word, let alone suggest we need a better deal with the European Union than Boris Johnson's, we are being unhelpful. Several sources said the MP Carolyn Harris, Keir Starmer's parliamentary aide with responsibility for coordinating with Labour members, including on what questions they ask at Prime Minister's question time, had been discouraging interventions on Brexit, saying they would damage the leader, with difficulties for British exporters continuing and problems over the Irish protocol unresolved. One member of Keir Starmer's front bench team said, attempts to brush the problems under the carpet just because we wrongly voted for Boris Johnson's deal in December is pretty close to negligence. He added that Keir Starmer was terrified of offending voters in red wall seats in the Midlands and the North, where pro-Brexit voters deserted Labour at the 2019 election. Since 1st of January, Keir Starmer has not raised Brexit on or problems caused by Brexit once at Prime Minister's question time, and interventions on the issue from backbenchers have been rare. None of the shadow cabinet or frontbench team have made a speech in Parliament on the issues affecting UK businesses. Pressure is now building on Labour leader Keir Starmer and his shadow cabinet to lay out a vision of how he would try to improve access to the European Union single market, the UK's biggest export market, after it emerged that thousands of British firms that export to the bloc are struggling with extra costs and extra bureaucracy, driving many to invest in warehouses and subsidiaries on the continent, while scaling down and laying off staff in the United Kingdom. At a special meeting of the parliamentary party before Keir Starmer's speech, Neil Coyle, the MP for Bermondsey and Old Southwark, said Labour should make a land grab to become the party of business, given how damaging Brexit had been to trade. Neil Coyle called for an extension of a theme in Starmer's speech about a new partnership with business to cover the immediate concerns of every industry from fishing to finance, as a result of the severe limitations of the government's trade deal with the European Union. Former Transport Secretary Andrew Adonis said it was incredible that Starmer had chosen not to mention Brexit in his speech. Keir Starmer's speech on the economic challenges ahead didn't once mention the words Brexit, trade, or Europe. This is unsustainable. It's like discussing the weather without mentioning the wind and the rain. Referring to Starmer's plan for a recovery bond, he added, the best British recovery bond would be to rejoin the European Customs Union and single market as soon as possible. Slashing our trade and raising prices at this moment is disastrous. The crisis Britain faces isn't its capacity to borrow, which has never been cheaper, but rather mass unemployment and an economic slump. Brexit is a major cause of both. Labour won't be credible until it promises to fundamentally renegotiate Boris Johnson's damaging trade reduction treaty with Europe. Meanwhile, the Green Party's Caroline Lucas, whose party has shown some signs of pushing up in the opinion polls in recent weeks, said, "It beggars belief that in his much-trailed reset speech on business and the economy, the leader of the opposition, Keir Starmer, himself once the most pro-European member of the shadow cabinet, couldn't even bring himself to mention the B word even once."
Food for thought.
Salam, and on the threshold of the blessed birthday of the Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali, peace be upon him, the first infallible successor of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, let us contemplate on a brief but bright aphorism from him. People perish due to two things: fear of poverty and seeking of pride.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
This man changed the world.
Allahu Akbar, Khomeini Rahbar. Allahu Akbar, Khomeini Rahbar.
Our bosses couldn't cope with the idea of an 80-year-old Ayatollah, which they didn't even know what an Ayatollah was, who lived on garlic and onions and yogurt, directing a revolution that was about to topple America's most important ally.
Shoma dar in qarn mojiza kardid, millat-e Iran, millat-e mojiza asaye qarn ast.
Allahu Akbar, Khomeini Rahbar. Allahu Akbar, Khomeini Rahbar. Allahu Akbar.
We seek refuge in Allah from the accursed Satan. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Exalted, the Most Compassionate, the Most Merciful. Salam, hello and welcome to our audience, and a warm welcome to our listeners of our program, The Man Who Changed the World. This is a program dedicated to the memory of Imam Khomeini, may God bless his great soul. And I'm your host on this program, Ijaz Hussain. The topic today on the program is polarization. And with me to discuss this particular topic is Dr. Matty Turabi. Salam, sir, and welcome to the program.
Alaykum salam wa rahmatullah. Thank you for inviting me.
Thank you. This was a topic we were speaking about in the last session, and it was a very important topic because you were pointing out the fact that, you know, we as Muslims and believers, even our Holy Prophet, peace be upon him, when he, at the advent of Islam, had enemies. Mm-hmm. Because when you're doing things for God, and you're struggling for principle, you're bound to have people who are against you.
Right.
And I think you give us, you know, at least a pretty big background on the stand of Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, because this is what the program is dedicated to. And of course, Imam Khomeini also had that effect because of the fact that he came out of the living teachings of the Holy Ahlul Bayt, and of course, he had supporters and he had enemies. So I leave the stage entirely to yourself, sir, to
thank you.
Expand.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Yeah, the point we were making,
in the last program was that some referenced and mentioned that very good book, an excellent book written by Shaid Muhtadi about the polarization.
That's correct, yeah, the polarization of Imam Ali, that's right.
Right, where he talks about how the personality of Imam Ali was a personality that attracted immensely and also repulsed immensely. And we said that that's actually also what happened with the Prophet in a different manner, in the sense that he, because he was Rahmatullah Alameen, he couldn't maybe say certain things in a way with that directness or do certain things with that kind of directness that Imam Ali alayhi salam was doing. But basically that the Prophet and Imam Ali alayhi salam were a team.
Yes.
That complemented each other in many ways. Yes. Obviously the Prophet, peace be upon him, being the boss and being the Prophet and the one that receives the revelation and is the one that is the connection to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in that sense. So I'm not saying team as equals.
No.
They're not a team of equals.
No.
The Prophet is...
The Prophet.
The Prophet and way above, you know, the Imam. But it was the combination of the two that was able to, you know, bring Islam.
Yes.
And in a sense, the way that Allah has planned it is that Imam Ali took over those functions or many of those functions that a Prophet might have to do, but which might repulse some people from the Prophet. Because the point of the Prophet is to attract.
Yes.
More than to repulse. It doesn't mean that they don't repulse.
No, but it was more to attract.
Right. Because there is a natural repulsion of people who don't want to accept truth.
That's
this has nothing to do with the personality of the person.
No.
If a person with any personality is standing up for truth, there are going to be people who are repulsed by that, or who will be his enemies.
His enemies, yes.
Because that's the nature of truth.
Yes.
Truth is the thing that distinguishes itself.
That's right.
From other things. This is the nature of truth.
Well, I mean, there's an Arabic saying for this kind of thing. It says, "Truth is bitter."
Right. Exactly. It's in English as well. We have the bitter truth, whatever.
Exactly.
It's the thing that differentiates.
Sheets.
Distinguish in the sense of distinguishing from this from that.
Exactly.
This is, you know, you get to a point where this is no longer the case.
Mm.
The facts no longer are this.
Yes.
This is, these are the facts.
Yes.
Okay? So this is going to cause problems for some people.
It will.
So, we discussed Imam Khomeini's personality as a polarizing figure in that context. In the sense of, and let's be very clear, and repeat what we're saying, that as a fully immersed, excellent student of the Prophet, peace be upon him, and Imam Ali alayhi salam,
yes,
he is a reflection of the personality of his guides and teachers.
Exactly.
And
exactly.
Leaders.
Exactly.
He is like Imam Ali, mm, alayhi salam.
Mm.
So, as Imam Ali, his personality was one that attracted many and repulsed many.
Exactly.
Exactly like his mullah. Exactly like his imam.
Exactly.
Okay? So, this is what we were saying in terms of this characteristic of, and we also said, and this is important to point out, that anyone who really is a mu'min is going to have aspects of this in their character, of this characteristic.
They certainly will.
Right?
Certainly
in their personality. Or it's going to have aspects of this. Mm. Some more, some less. You cannot be a mu'min and not have enemies.
Exactly.
Let's be very clear about that. You cannot be a mu'min and not have enemies. You are going to at least have at least one enemy. And people say, well, is that something you made up? I said, look in the Quran. It says, for every prophet, we have sent an enemy.
Exactly.
So if you're a follower of that prophet, you're going to have enemies.
Quite.
This is something, it's not, you know, God is giving us is informing us of a reality when he says that in the Quran. He's informing us of a reality. For every prophet, we sent an enemy. So if you're a follower of the Prophet, you're going to have enemies. If you're not,
right,
you might not have enemies. And this brings us to a very, very important subject, which is something that we need to discuss as believers, as a community, as believing Muslims, which I think has been a major, major problem in the Muslim community. And that is that we have a very distorted and, I believe, wrong understanding of what it means to be a holy person.
Now, that's a point I wanted to raise as well, Dr. Mahdi Tarabi, because when you talk about holy people, there's a false image out there that somehow a holy guy is nice to everyone. That's not what being holy is about, is it?
Well, I would say, in principle, what you're saying is right. The point of being a holy person is not that you are somehow, you know, blissfully, you know, riding, you know, a foot above the ground, and you know everything that around you turns into flowers
and all that kind of thing. Yeah,
that's not what it is.
Yeah.
Okay.
And somehow Satan can sing from the same hymn sheet as yourself.
Right. The whole point of religion, and I mean religion in the larger sense of religion, those religions that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has revealed, you know, time of existence of humanity.
Sure.
They are there as a source of distinguishing humans, not as necessarily getting everyone together.
That's right. It's distinguishing them, isn't it?
It's about distinguishing. It's
differentiation.
Distinguishing,
talking about.
Not in a racist way, not in a
no,
you know,
it's based on merit,
chauvinistic
isn't it?
Way
no,
in the sense
no,
of. And this is one of the main arguments that the people who are against religion will say about religion. Religion divides people.
Yes.
Religion causes wars. Religion causes evil. Religion encourages, you know, the base instincts of people.
Mm.
And I'm sure that religions have done this in history.
Of course they have.
Because people are involved with religions.
Of course they
have. So the people that are involved in religions do this.
Yes.
It could even be me. I'm not saying that.
Yeah.
You know, this is distinguished from the issue of what the job of religion is.
Mm.
The job of religion is to distinguish people. Based on one basis, those who accept the truth and try to act on it in their life,
yes,
and those who reject it and fight it. Okay, I said it in a very general way because I don't want it to, you know, this is a universal matter, whether it was, you know, the revelations that were given to the older prophets and the prophets before Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, or whether it's the revelation that was given to Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, which is the first universal and the final revelation.
Sure.
It's there to distinguish people. It's not about everybody getting together and, you know,
singing kumbaya.
Exactly. It's not about that.
No.
For God's sakes.
I mean, this is the thing.
It doesn't mean you treat other people badly. It doesn't mean
you don't respect them. No, no.
It doesn't mean that you don't live with them. It doesn't mean that you don't cooperate in certain matters.
No.
Okay, it's not about everybody. Oh, everybody's the same. Everybody's just as good. Oh, you know, go kiss the hand of the person who just stole from you. Oh, go, you
yeah,
know.
And you know, slap me on the other cheek. You know, that kind of thing. No, that's not what it's about. No.
So, when somebody understands this reality of religion
because
and starts acting on that, obviously they're going to polarize.
Well, the thing is that what's more polarizing, I would say, is, you know, one of the principles that we have in Islam, which, you know, is even difficult for even Muslims to act upon with other fellow believers, and that is to enjoin the good and forbid the evil.
Which is an example of that.
This is really the heart and crux of what we're seeing here, because this polarization, there's a legislative, a ruling bylaw, divine law, that says, well, you know, okay, you can be a good person, you believe in the truth, that's great. God says that's wonderful. But when you see your neighbor doing something, or your friend, or your brother doing something I forbade, well, it's your job to go and tell him not to do that. That's hard.
Yeah, because
your brother's not going to like you for that.
Well, it could be that when you say to somebody, you know, please don't do that.
No. Or your father, for example.
Or whoever.
Yeah.
Okay?
Yeah.
Obviously, they're not going to like it.
They're not going to like it.
If they're into doing that.
Yeah.
Or if they feel like, who are you to tell me?
Yeah, exactly.
They might even know that it's not good.
Yeah, I mean, especially in societies where, you know, you and I have lived, you know, in Scotland, for example, I know that if you say, you know, Jim, don't have a drink, you get... You get punched in
the
face.
Don't say it.
But you don't say it. You,
you don't say that to Jim, right?
But don't say it to Jim. But, you know, if you say it to Abdul,
yeah,
you've got a point, you know.
Exactly.
So this is the whole point, isn't it? That when we get down to the crux of the matter, this Amr bin Maruf is a very important duty. And this is one of the things that, you know, that even when we discuss Ashura, when we discuss Muharram, when we discuss, you know, these great changes, these great events that change the course of history, this is the hardest principle on which to act upon as a believer. And this is the test. I mean, that's what we're talking about here, because
so,
this is the real
so
test.
So this is the deal. Actually, if you read the Islamic government, Hukumat-e-Islami Velayat Faqih,
that's
the
right,
book by Imam, it's a very good book to read. It's not simply a legal treatise.
No, it's not.
It's
no.
more than that.
Oh.
He talks about the fact that we were beset in the Muslim world by what he called or the way it's translated, is pseudo-saints.
Pseudo-saints,
yes. In Farsi, it's Khushk Muqaddas.
Right.
Which, if you want to translate it, you know, very literally, is dried-up holy person.
A dried-up holy person. Right.
A dry holy person.
I've heard of dry apricot, but,
right.
you know.
Basically, what he's trying to say is that it's a fake, it's this fake holiness.
Sure.
You know, don't get involved with politics.
That's right. It's trying to
don't get involved with politics.
Exactly.
You know, be nice to everything. You know, if mm-hmm. the Shah is coming, you know, go kiss his hand.
Yeah.
Because, hey, he is the Shah and you're part of, you know. Sure. And there's that famous story.
Mm.
Again, we're talking about Imam Khomeini and his personality.
This is the late 50s.
This is the late 50s.
And
the Shah announces, I'm coming to Qom to have a meeting with the ulama.
Right.
Because I'm the Shah, I can do this.
I see.
And they all have to attend.
All right.
Okay?
Right.
So this is the picture. Imagine this.
Sure.
So the Shah rides into, well, figuratively speaking, you know, with a car. He was a car. He drives into Qom.
Drives into Qom.
Which is, you know, at that time, maybe 2-3 hours from Tehran with the roads and the cars of that time. Sure. Right? And he enters the room where all the main ulama are seated.
Yes.
And as Iranian custom, as Eastern custom, they all get up.
Mm-hmm.
Except who?
Imam Khomeini.
Exactly.
God bless his grace.
Exactly.
What a man.
And I just something popped in my mind right now. It's the reverse thing what Shaitan did.
Mm.
Who, when God said,
yes,
bow to the Imam of the
very
age.
Very good point. Excellent.
He didn't bow.
Mm-hmm.
This is Imam doing the reverse.
Verse.
Which is the guy who comes in and he says, you know, King of Kings and, you know,
the axis
of time, you know, Qutb-e Zaman and whatever, all
sure.
the things that the Iranians used to call their kings.
Yes.
He doesn't stand up for it.
He doesn't stand.
And, you know, it was a scandal.
Ooh.
It was
I'm
a
sure
scandal. Everybody's like, oh my God,
mm.
you know,
mm.
Ayatollah Khomeini didn't stand up for, you know, the king.
Yes.
You gotta love him.
He was doing the right thing.
He's like, you know what? I'm not going to stand up for the king.
Yes, and what are the other ulama doing? You know, right. I mean, did he pass something in Qom for which they should be standing up for?
Right.
You know?
So
this guy was, you know.
So,
yeah.
The point is that obviously doing things like this is going to upset some people.
Of course.
Even people who are quote unquote religious.
Ah.
Even people who are quote unquote, you know, whatever. We live according to Islam. Well.
Mm.
Part of Islam is that you don't show respect to somebody who is a zalim and who kills people and who tortures people and imprisons people without...
Yeah, and doesn't deserve that kind of respect.
Right.
Exactly.
Okay?
Exactly.
Right. And they say, well, what about... Isn't he also just a human, the king, you know? Isn't he just deserve that normal, basic, you know, thing that a human does? Well, we're like, well, no. Once you do certain things, you...
yeah, I mean, once
you're disqualified from
you're
that,
disqualified
from that list.
From God's...
You're
you
not.
Know.
It's not that he's not human. It's just, you know, you have to act human.
Exactly. Exactly.
It's not like you're physically a human being. Therefore, you know, you have to act like you.
And if you're a fasik, then you know you.
Fasik is fasik.
Yeah, you're out.
Okay. Maybe. There are certain things that are no longer. And we're not talking dry, you know, legal aspects of it.
No.
Okay.
No.
So. We have this person Imam Khomeini. He does these things from way back.
Mm.
We're not even talking.
No, it's not even. Yeah.
I'll give you another example,
please.
This is during his, I think this was in the 30s or 20s. I'm sorry, 30s or 40s.
Sure.
They're in Fezziyeh and some mentally deranged person comes in
mm-hmm.
with a knife.
Yes, he was going to stab the Imam.
And they were going to stab different, he was going around threatening people.
People.
So most of the ulama, they fled.
Mm-hmm.
What did Imam do?
He slapped him.
He gave him a big slap.
Slap right in his, and the knife fell from the hand and the man was shaking.
Right?
Mm.
So, oh, this is not appropriate. You know, if somebody is threatening a Rouhani and, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
What should you're a Rouhani, you're a cleric, and then somebody is threatening you with a knife. What's the, you know, the pseudo-saint way of reacting? Is to just, you know, fold up and be like, oh, please don't kill me, or my son, you know, go ahead and take my life. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Right?
Mm.
So, but what's the real way? What's the real answer?
The real answer is to give him a good bloody hiding, as we would say in Scotland.
Right?
Yes.
The whole story with Jim and Abdullah, right?
Yeah,
Abdul,
yes,
right?
Exactly.
Right?
Because the thing, you know, quite rightly so, because, I mean, here's a...
That's what a holy person, a real holy person
does.
Okay? Because the guy is going to damage himself as well.
Exactly.
If he stabs somebody, he's going to have to be punished. He's going to go... So, Imam, I'm saying this as an example. People are like, oh, you're mythologizing him and turning...
No.
No, it's about what is your reaction.
Mm.
when a real thing happens in your life.
Sure.
Okay?
And this required decisive action. I mean, the thing is that let's not even... you mentioned that example, and I thank you for that. And of course, you know, this is all to the credit and greatness of Imam Khomeini, because now we realize what kind of personality he's going to become later on. But of course, you know, we see this with the prophets as well. I mean, Prophet Moses punches a guy and knocks his lights out,
right?
Well, I put that in, you know, in the nicest possible way I can.
Right.
But he killed him.
Right.
Right. And this was one of Pharaoh's soldiers, one of his guards, right? And that was a serious offense. I mean, that was the death penalty, you know. And that's what I'm saying. I mean, there's a precedent for this. This is what real men do.
Well, the point is that
when you stand up for truth,
yeah,
this polarizes people.
Sure.
This repulses some people.
Mm.
Okay?
Yeah.
And that's what a really saintly person does.
Exactly.
Okay? Especially in... You see, this is the beautiful thing about Islam, which is different than the other things that the other religions have become.
Exactly, these sort of pseudo...
Okay, right? The yeah. ideal, for example, in some of the Christian churches has become to, you know, be a monk.
Yeah.
Or be some sort of a recluse, or be a celibate.
Exactly.
Which
exactly.
is, they say, you know, you,
yeah,
you like in the Catholic Church,
yeah,
like in the Catholic Church, you can't be a priest unless you're celibate.
Yeah.
Which, you know, there is a history of fighting and soldier and priests going to war, but it's not the dominant vision of what a thing is. Okay?
Yes, exactly.
Or, you know, in certain Eastern traditions where it's like, you know, you got to renounce the world and whatever and
yeah,
all that.
Yeah.
I mean, that's not the truth.
No, it's not.
That's not the truth.
No.
Okay? So we have a person like Imam Khomeini who is the embodiment and manifestation of his teachers, which are the Ahlul Bayt, which is the Prophet, peace be upon him, which is Imam Ali alayhi salam.
Sure.
And I would say that even among the Imams, you have a very special... Obviously, we always say that Imam Ali has the top position among the Imams.
Of course.
And he's also the one that is the most... And we're not talking about what's going to happen with the Zuhur of Imam Zaman. We're talking about those that we've experienced. He's the one that is the most, you know, attracting and repulsing of all of them.
Sure.
And there are many, many stories of him, you know, in the early history of Islam, and so I'm not going to go through all of them, but I'll give you another example of Imam Khomeini. So
please.
We were talking about this previously, where, you know, he flies into Tehran after years and years of exile, you know, in order to lead the revolution, and he's at the airport, I'm sure you remember, and you know, they bring the children's choir, and they're singing that beautiful, you know, choral
surud
that about Imam, and you know, very emotional.
Yes, it
scene.
Was. It was a
you
very
know,
emotional.
People
scene.
Were losing it. People were crying, and
absolutely.
Imam, not a flicker of a muscle on his face.
Exactly.
Totally. Okay. Then the reporter says to him, "Oh, you know the Eastern kind of style of, like, you know, so after all these years you know, what's your feeling about, you know, coming back to your homeland?" And he just looks at him and says,
Heech.
That famous Heech.
That
right?
famous Heech.
Right. So
that caught the BBC by the pants, as they say.
Right.
You know, it really.
So,
you know,
obviously, people are like, what does that mean? He's a holy person. Shouldn't she? You know, people are expecting him to give, like, some long, Hafiz poem about, you know.
Yeah, Hafiz poem or something, you know, something mystical about his return.
Some, you know,
the rise of a phoenix or something like that, you know.
You know, phoenix rising out of the ashes.
Yeah, exactly, out of the ashes,
you know,
or something,
like,
you know.
That's what they expect.
Exactly.
Because this is the cultural thing that they think is going to. And his whole thing is, it's not about this.
It's not about,
you know, this kind of rituals. It's not about it's about the reality of things.
Exactly.
Okay? What's your feeling about
him? Nothing.
Whether I'm there or here.
Live with it.
Well, what is he saying? Let's think about this for a second.
Yeah, exactly.
He's saying that it doesn't matter where I am in the world.
Exactly.
The world is not that important, actually.
No.
Okay?
Yeah.
Whether I am, you know, in exile, you know,
yes,
difficulty, or whether I'm the leader of a nation.
That's not important.
What's your feeling? Nothing.
Nothing.
That's the goal. Is that it shouldn't make a difference.
And it make a difference.
Whether you're the leader or not the leader. Okay? If you're the leader, you have the same feeling as though you were, you know, some respectable old cleric, you know, sitting in his home giving lessons to his
students.
Yeah. Okay?
Sure.
Fantastic. And this is the test that Allah wants from us. The things I'm saying, obviously, I'm not applying to myself, because I fail in all those.
I'm trying to simply understand what a person like Imam Khomeini, who in our time was really the closest we had to, you know, that masum guidance that you could see, you know, with your own eyes, at least in my experience.
Absolutely.
You know, whatever. I think a lot of people feel that way.
Yeah,
so we see this is his deal. He's like, it doesn't matter. I've, you know, there's millions of people waiting in the streets to greet me, and you know, I'm not impressed by this, which is great. You know, it's fantastic. Right?
It really is, yeah. I mean, it was a big eye-opener. I mean, as
it's fantastic,
say,
right? Yeah, yeah. So he goes to Beit Zahra.
Zahra, yeah.
And, you know, it's, again, very emotional, even more so emotional than you know, at the airport, because we're going to the graves of the martyrs. The martyrs' families are there.
Yeah.
And then they sing that song, that poem, which is, you know, just thinking about it, you know, sends shivers down my spine, you know?
Sure.
It's the surud about the shuhada.
Yes.
And everybody knows it in Iran, and it's an amazing poem.
Yes.
And if you look at the film, everybody is crying.
Yes.
You know, his son, Haj Ahmed, is crying. Alayna Tehnuri is sitting there. He lost his turban.
I remember the film. Yeah? Yes, I remember.
Everybody's crying.
Crying, yes.
Everybody's crying.
Except
Imam. So, you know, in an Eastern emotional society, like...
And where the Imam does get emotional is the point where he says, I'm going to smash this government in the teeth.
Exactly.
And that's what it's about, mate.
Listen, and this is the thing for them. They are shocked. They're like, oh my God, a cleric.
Yeah.
An old 80-year-old cleric. Mm. Isn't he supposed to be the one that, you know, oh, let's invite Aghai Bakhtiari and let's invite so-and-so and let's get it together and let's come to some, you know... And he's like, nope. This person who is the prime minister is not legitimate.
No.
Because the person who appointed him wasn't legitimate.
No. Absolutely.
Right? Because they said to him, they said, again, we're repeating some of the history, but I think this is very good
very important to
see what a personality of a real holy person
is like.
Because they said to him when he came to Iran, I mentioned this in previous programs, I want to repeat it because I think it's a very interesting story.
Sure.
They said to him, you know what, fine, the Shah has left, Bakhtiar has taken over the government, why don't you just go back to Iran, go to Qom and, you know, be the Ayatollah Uzma.
Yeah.
Do your Ayatollah Uzma thing.
And leave.
And let
Bakhtiar take care of the country.
Every now and then, if you really think a red line is being crossed, issue a fatwa, we'll live with that.
We'll live with that.
What did he say? Oh, and then they threatened him. It was a thruffer, right?
Yeah, it was a thruffer, yes.
They said, and if you don't do that, we will tell the military to conduct a coup d'etat, and they will arrest all of you and execute all of you.
Yes, and he said, I will declare.
He said, and this is the Americans sending him this message through Ibrahim Yazdi, who was leader of the Freedom Movement. You know, had good connections with the Americans.
Sure.
Because of his time living in America and being a U.S. citizen.
Sure.
Okay? So, at that time, through Ibrahim Yazdi, they sent him a message saying this. What is his response?
I'll declare jihad.
I will declare jihad.
Yes.
What did Kissinger say?
He said something we don't understand.
He said, we don't understand what he's... from where he's coming from.
Coming from, right. Exactly.
He's
using religious terminology and religious...
It's not something we learned in Harvard.
It's not something we learned in Harvard.
Right, it's not something I can teach at Harvard to the kids, you know, about, you know... It doesn't fit to the 19th century, you know, European balance of power state model, okay?
Yes, exactly.
He's from another time and place. We don't know what to do with him.
No.
So, here's a man... He says to the Americans, hey, you do this, it's jihad.
Mm-hmm.
He comes to Iran. How do you feel? What's your feeling?
Peach.
He comes to Beit Zahra.
Yes.
Doesn't cry when everybody, the whole nation's crying.
He doesn't cry.
And then he says, you know what? I'm going to suck this. I'm going to punch this government to the mouth.
Mouth. Because it's not legitimate.
It's not legitimate. And with the help of the people, I am going to establish a government.
That's where he was very passionate.
I as a religious leader, not I as a man personal, whatever.
Or, yes.
Me as the head and, you know, top legal scholar, I'm going to establish a government. And we're going to have an Islamic Republic.
Problem.
Although he didn't mention Islamic Republic in that
speech. At that time, but of course later on that was the case.
So, all this stuff, completely against the grain of, you know, Eastern culture, Iranian culture, whatever, even certain other things. You see this with Imam Ali alayhi salam going completely against some of those Arab, you know, customs.
Yes, in a very...
Tribalism.
Yes.
That tribal favoritism with your tribe, with your family, you know, all those things that, you know, you would... That really are a way of preventing haq, of preventing the truth happening.
Yeah.
This famous example of when his cousin wants money from Baitul Mal, which we mentioned before, program.
He put a hot pebble in his...
Yeah, he had, you know, he was, he couldn't see very well, Imam Ali alayhi salam put a hot coal in his hand and said, said, this is, feel this, hell when you take money from,
from Baitul Mal.
Right?
Yes.
So people think, oh, that's very harsh, that's very, you know...
No, that's not harsh.
He's just telling him, he's getting to the point.
He's getting to the facts. That's going to happen anyway.
Right.
You know,
so he's getting it.
Put this coal in your hand.
He's getting there quicker than maybe somebody else.
Somebody else, yes.
And this is the same with Imam Khomeini.
Sure.
He came, he did the things that he had to do, he was successful, and that's why, you know, tens of millions of people loved him, and tens of millions of people hated him. And Allah likes that.
Allah likes that. Thank you very much. On that note, sir, thank you very much indeed for the contribution for the man who changed the world. And it just leaves me to thank our listeners and to say, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. May the peace and mercy and blessings of Allah be upon you all. Thank you for listening. Goodbye.
To the light. Police across the globe are using new methods to prevent crime and improve their performance. Now, Pakistani police have come up with an idea to put officers on rollerblades to catch criminals in the commercial hub Karachi. The new armed rollerblading unit is going through rigorous training for over a month with the aim of curbing theft and harassment on the streets. During the training, they were seen carefully balancing on skates while leaping